Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 16, 2022. We're here on our second matter of three for oral argument this morning, A21-1053 Logdahl versus Logdahl. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. I'd also ask that when you are not speaking, that you mute yourself. Okay, so we're ready to proceed. Counsel?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. My name is Steve Nelson. I represent Roger Logdahl. We are the appellants on this matter. This is a divorce case. It was tried in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and we are appealing a post trial order denying our motion for a new trial or amended proceedings that was entered on July 19th, 2021. Facts of this case, Your Honor, is simply
Mr. Nelson, and I do have some bad audio, so I hope you can hear me. Isn't it also true that there's another option for this court, and that is to remand to the district court to make findings in light of Bender, because Bender, the Supreme Court decision was issued after this matter arose?
I'm sorry, I will not hear what you're saying.
I don't need to ask the question. I think panel members can punt, perhaps.
Judge Werke was asking if we have the option of remanding it for additional findings by the district court. Is that your question, Judge Werke? All right.
Oh, yes, that's correct. We are asking to have it remanded for additional findings by the district court. And I'll give the basis for that in my brief statement of facts. The divorce case was primarily a property settlement. And I'm assuming, based on the fact that the judge in that case took a lot of care in making sure the assets of the parties, the marital assets, were equally divided, even to the point where there was a $3,700 adjustment that was paid by my client, Roger Logdahl, to the wife, in order to equalize the values that were found in the case. One of the assets that is critical in this appeal was the value of property in Gig Harbor, Washington. That property had been appraised by the bank within a couple of years prior to the trial, and the court was presented with values that ranged from $335,000 to $380,000. Having those values before it, the court accepted an appraisal that had been done by a bank that was approximately 2 years before the trial and valued the property at $335,000. This property was awarded to the wife as part of the distribution. Now, the property was valued at $335,000, but the actual equity in this property over and above the existing mortgage was about $40,000. And so the wife had received a $40,000 asset in receiving the Gig Harbor property. It's interesting to note that at the time of the trial, the wife was living in Minnesota, near Big Fork, Minnesota. The husband was living in the property that we're talking about here in Gig Harbor. He also was employed there as an engineer. So he lived on the property incidental to his employment. The court issued the order in June of 2020, but delayed the actual division of the assets until November of 2020. This allowed the parties, of course, to readjust. They had to move out of the home. They had to vacate the home, and the home had to be transferred. My client was on the mortgage, on the Gig Harbor mortgage, at the time of the trial, and continued on that mortgage until the distribution was made by the parties. Now, the wife had a difficulty getting financing, didn't start right away to try to do that, and made a motion to extend the distribution of the property.
It's my understanding the reason that she didn't seek refinancing right away was that she had to show 6 months of income, and she needed to have the spousal maintenance to do that. So that put her in after the November date, as I understand the record.
That was her argument. However, she had been receiving spousal maintenance, and she had had 6 months of spousal maintenance by that time. She wasn't employed other than that, that I can recall. But her argument was that she had to have that additional time. Whatever the reason, the court extended the distribution of this property from November 30th until March 31st. Now, as a practical matter, and what the facts showed is that sometime mid-April, wife was able to obtain the financing and buy the husband out of the property. Now, why was this a disadvantage to him? For the very reason that we're sitting here. Between January of 2020 and the time the property was distributed in February of 2021, there's been a tremendous increase in value of properties, probably because of COVID. None of us really knew why. We were suspecting that at the time. Looking back historically, it seems like that was one of the reasons. But there was a 40% increase in the value of the Gig Harbor property during that period of time. What that meant to the wife is a 400% increase in what she was awarded to the husband's detriment. Now, this case also involved alimony, and the alimony was based on the property and the income of the parties. Suddenly, what we have here, because of the inflation of the Gig Harbor property, is a tremendous asset that the wife is receiving. Instead of receiving,
why isn't this true for pretty much any property settlement? I mean, any property settlement that happened at or around the beginning of the pandemic, those properties probably, as you noted, all increased significantly in value. And I mean, I'm concerned that the rule of law here that it seems like you're suggesting is that all of those settlements can be unwound because maybe they're not so equitable anymore given the fluctuations in the market. And that seems to be problematic to me, at least.
I agree it's problematic, and it's problematic for a lot of people. What the court is going to do about it is going to be on a case-by-case basis, I'm sure, because many of these divorces are the same as what we're talking here. Property values are tied into alimony and also future entitlements. But nevertheless, I don't think that that erodes the fact that there was a very substantial increase, and the substantial increase was very critical in this case. And that brings to question the last sentence of Minnesota 518, which simply states that if there is a significant value modified in an asset, the court has the opportunity to revalue it. And
so what is it about the court's decision that is an abuse of discretion here? When the district court says, I'm not going to reopen it, or I'm not going to revalue the property, why is that for us to second guess in this particular case?
Well, and I understand that the Court of Appeals is not anxious to start rewriting the judgments of the district court judges that handle these divorce cases. But what made it difficult for us is simply this. Roger was locked on the mortgage. He couldn't refinance himself. along with the increase in value of this property, the properties that he would be buying to replace it also increased in value. And so until he was off the mortgage, he was not financially able to go out and seek other property when he had to vacate on the 20th of November. He had vacated and he was prepared to go forward. He was locked in, he couldn't. And so by doing this, the property wasn't actually distributed. In the fact that my client was not off the mortgage to allow him the freedom to replace that property until mid-February of 2021. And the statute is clear that if there's a significant value between the date of the order and the date of distribution, then the court can open that up. In this case, there was
But Mr. Nelson, the statute says the court may, so it's not shall, not mandatory. And our standard of review is abuse of discretion.
Well, you're absolutely right, of course. The court may do it or may not. But under these circumstances, when you have a 400% increase in the value of an asset that you've awarded, that you've taken great care to divide the values between the husband and the wife, and the court met right down to the penny, making an equal division of these assets. So I know that it was the intention of the court in the original order to divide the assets equally. And she did a great job of it. But what nobody knew is that there'd be a tremendous increase in this property. This property is probably more so than others because it's close to the ocean on the West Coast. But nevertheless, the saving value is the last sentence of the statute, which says when there's a significant value, the court has the opportunity to reschedule. Okay, so she didn't. I admit, if it was her intent to skew the value of the assets between the parties, she had every right to do that. If that was her order, if that was what I truly believe was her intent, then I wouldn't be here in front of you. But that wasn't her intent. It was the intent of this court to equalize the value. It happened that at the time of distribution, there was not any equity there. You have a wife that received the majority of the assets by a long shot. A 400% increase in the value that the court thought they were awarding is significant. And as a result, that makes a different playing field. And the court should exercise its discretion to reconsider this. It's still judicial discretion, but it's an abuse of discretion when you ignore these facts and you ignore the law. And that's what happened in this case. The judge, and I have a lot of respect for the district court judges, and I just have to say, under these circumstances, under this set of facts, the abuse of discretion was to not revalue this property, not in grant the defendant's or the respondent's motion for a revaluation and the respondent's motion for a new trial. And that's why we're here today. Now, is this newly discovered evidence? Well, it is. And while we are waiting for this appeal to proceed, we had a case that was decided that's definitely in our favor, and that's the Bender case. And the Bender case, Bender versus Barnhart, was decided on March 9th of 2022. What that case simply indicates is that the old standard, the post-decision newly discovered standard, is out the window. The court has to consider whether or not the newly discovered evidence was discoverable before the relevant proceeding with the exercise of due diligence. Well, what we have here is a knowledge that the value of the Gig Harbor property is going to probably increase, but nobody, as we sit here now, would have guessed that there would be a 40% increase in less than 6 months. I mean, that is substantial, and that is unusual, and that is critical. The court also has to determine whether that value would have been admissible at trial. Certainly would have been. If we had tried this case in August of or November of 2020, the value, the Zillow value of that gig hybrid property would have been relevant and would have been admitted by the court instead of dealing with a $330,000 property. The court would have been dealing with a $550,000 property. Would have made a big difference in the judgment. And lastly, would it have affected the outcome of the case? Well, I think it would have. Not only would it have affected the outcome in the division of assets, but it would have affected the court's award of spousal maintenance, or at least would have given the court a reason to not award spousal maintenance.
Counsel? Your time has expired. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. All right. Thank you. Counsel, anytime you're ready. Counsel, you're muted.
Am I unmuted now for the court? Thank you. I apologize. My mouse is being very uncooperative.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to begin first with the 518.58 subdivision argument. We argued this two separate times before the trial court. And the argument really about the application of 58.58 in my analysis is that the clause of a significant change in the value of an asset occurs between the valuation date and the final distribution of the property. When the judgment and decree is final, that clause for modifying a valuation date for an asset no longer exists. And that interpretation is in fact consistent with the case law that is included in my brief and with the case law that was offered by the appellant in his argument. Each of the cases that Mr. Nelson has set forth on behalf of his client, Mr. Logdahl, all deal with changes in value that have occurred between the valuation date and the end of the time for a timely appeal. In this case, the time to appeal that judgment and decree expired in September of 2020. And I'll just go quickly through each of those cases. He references Bolenbach. And in reviewing Bolenbach, it is a case where the trial court set out a payment or a distribution of an asset about a year in advance. And what the court determined in that case is that the trial court should include language to contemplate or consider fluctuations in an asset such as the stock market, which is stocks, which is known to fluctuate rapidly and quickly in the language. But the last piece of that analysis, and I believe it's a cite from Kiso, is that so long as the judgment is not final. So once the appeal rights have expired, that judgment is final and it's no longer subject to being an adjustment of a valuation date of an asset under 518.58. That interpretation is also consistent with the continual statutory thread about what is the court's jurisdiction in property distribution cases. And the intent is that property distribution reaches a point of finality quickly. And the court has limited jurisdiction over property distribution, except for a couple of exceptions, which I'll come to soon, has limited jurisdiction. It cannot modify or amend a property distribution based on changed circumstances. It is only, its jurisdiction is limited to enforcing the distribution of the assets and to assisting the parties in making that happen. So once that appeal time expired in September, really the ability to bring a request for a modification based on 518.58 would not have merit. And the trial court indeed decided that it was not going to reevaluate that asset based on 518.58. In its order, which is not identified to be an order under appeal for this argument, but it was included in the addendum, the trial court did point the appellant to 518.145 and stated in its findings that neither party brought a motion for fraud or mistake or newly discovered evidence. Shortly after that decision came out, appellant then did move for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, resting on that newly discovered evidence being a Zillow ad and later identifying a lender appraisal that was a part of my client's lending package and was a necessary step in completing the refinancing. Just a couple of facts that I think are important for the court to know. Ms. Logdahl, the respondent in this matter and my client, did not have 6 consecutive months of spousal maintenance with which to proceed at the time that the judgment was entered in June of 2020. She had 6 months as of June of 2020. However, the temporary maintenance ended when the final order was put in place and the court ordered Mr. Logdahl to begin permanent spousal maintenance on August 1st. That created an interruption. And Ms. Logdahl negotiated with her lender throughout the process to see if there could be an exception. And the lender was unable to provide an exception to their requirement of 6 months of consecutive consistent income. That is what caused the delay and precluded the refinancing from being completed in November of 2020. Ms. Logdahl did file a motion in November requesting an extension and continued to work with her lender. We kept the court apprised of Ms. Logdahl's progress and informed the court in January that her loan had been approved. She had met the 6-month mark. Her loan had been approved and she was set to close. She was prohibited from closing in January of 2021 because in spite of the order in the judgment and decree, Mr. Logdahl declined to sign any papers to allow that closing to proceed. That triggered another motion to the court on behalf of Ms. Logdahl to have an order again, specifically that he comply within 24 hours with the lending team to complete this financing, and that he be ordered to pay costs, additional costs that Ms. Logdahl incurred as a result of his interference with her refinancing. The court did issue that order. The court did grant an extension because by the time we were in court in February, much of the work needed to be redone. So an extension was offered. Mr. Logdahl did comply with that subsequent order. And the court did order him to pay a little over $1,000 in additional costs that my client incurred in completing the refinancing. So to put those facts into perspective, and after Mr. Logdahl's motion under 518.58 was denied, he brought a motion to the court for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence. And his argument, as I understand it from his brief, is that Bender, the case that was released in March of 2022, shortly before his brief was due, requires the court to consider newly discovered evidence. And I think that is the basis for his request for a remand. But that is not the finding in Bender. The finding in Bender, as I read it, is that it reminded everyone that generally newly discovered evidence must be in existence at the time of trial. And simply adding that in says the door is never going to be completely closed on post-decision evidence. But that does not give any direction that would indicate that all newly discovered evidence, all post-decision evidence, must be unilaterally considered. It says generally. And the four-prong test includes that aspect. Generally, newly discovered evidence must have been in existence. It must have been undiscoverable without reasonable due diligence, relevant and admissible, and not collateral or cumulative. In the court's order, in addendum page 48, finding 22, the court found that an appraisal, which is what was offered as the newly discovered evidence, was with reasonable due diligence discoverable in time for those proceedings. And it was on that basis, and therefore on the analysis, that the court denied his motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence. Whether that is the discretion of the court to make that determination, her finding is clearly not erroneous. It's clearly within her discretion and indicates that, in fact, the court did do an analysis. Now, in my brief, I argue that in the alternative, an appraisal is expert testimony. And consistently, the courts have not allowed post-proceeding expert testimony to be accepted as newly discovered evidence. And that is shown in Clark, that is referenced in Swanson, and it is also referenced in Bender. So the decision of the trial court should be affirmed because, in fact, the court did make an analysis under the four-prong test and denied it, that an appraisal is actually expert testimony, and expert testimony procured after the proceedings is not newly discovered evidence, and it could have been simply denied on that matter. The application of 518.58 is no longer pertinent or relevant to this case. Once the decision became final, the ability to apply that clause was no longer available to the court. The two cases where the Supreme Court addressed post-decision evidence also is factually distinct from the case before this court today. In In Re Wood, it is a guardianship case. And in guardianship cases, the court's jurisdiction is different. The court has ongoing jurisdiction to make modifications based on changed circumstances. And that is cited in my brief. Also, in Bender, that is a child support case. So support, in matters of support, the court has ongoing jurisdiction for changed circumstances. That does not exist in property division. That jurisdiction is not available to the court. And therefore, I don't believe you're going to see much, if any, post-decision evidence being newly discovered for purposes of property division. It in fact represents changed circumstances. And the trial court is without jurisdiction to modify based on that. Therefore, the decision of the trial court should be affirmed. The court did not abuse its discretion and made its decision within the operation of the law.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. We'll reset the clock for you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Anytime you're ready, sir.
Thank you. I think the Bender case is critical because it considers the old rule that's been enunciated by my opponent that newly discovered evidence has to be in existence at the time of the judgment. Now, what we have in this particular case is an increase in value of real estate. It is no surprise to anybody that was participating in that trial that the real estate value would change, probably up, less likely down, but there would be some increase. So that was in existence. That was in existence at the time of the trial, at the time of the judgment, and subsequently to the judgment, that there would be some modification. What we were not aware of is that the change would be so significant, tremendously significant, a 40% value change in the asset and a 400% value change in the equity of that asset that was awarded to the wife. And so this fits really in hand with the Bender case. The Bender case said the new rule is you have to look at it. And it's abuse of discretion if the trial court does not look at it. The rule in the Bender case is simply that it has to be evidence that that made a substantial difference. Had to be evidence that would be admissible. And it has to be evidence that, if admitted and considered, would likely make a difference in the finding. And that actually goes back a half a century or more, because that was the rule prior to the Swanson case. So what we have here really is an abuse of discretion in the fact that the trial court had refused when the trial court knew and had evidence that the value of an asset was going to increase markedly, then it could have taken corrective action. It could have had a hearing. By not scheduling a hearing, that was the abuse of discretion. And that's the basis why we want that trial decision remanded, and we want to go back and have that hearing. We want the trial court to consider this. If the trial court considers all the evidence and makes the same finding again, so be it. But at least we should have the right to include this in the discussion. The standard is that the trial court has to consider the newly discovered evidence that it advises, and the holding in Bender is simply that the district court could have taken the action to grant some relief. If I didn't believe that the district court really intended to equalize the division of assets between the parties, it wouldn't be an issue. But everything in this case indicates an equal division of the assets, but for the fact of the tremendous increase in value caused by COVID, caused by the economy, caused by many factors, but nevertheless, unheard of increase in values have occurred in the last year, which has skewed these matters and has made them unfair. So we have a man going forward with permanent alimony to a wife who now has cash and assets than he has. The whole thing is skewed, and it should go back so the court can take the action necessary and consider the evidence. So the evidence is both newly discovered and also not. We knew that the value would change. The court knew the value might change, but not to the extent that it did. That's what's making it unfair. And that's what means that we should go back and the judge could consider it. And the judge can make its findings again accordingly. So I'm asking for a remand.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. The matter is now submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.